translation and purport. Next, the yogi should fix his mind in meditation on the personality of Godhead's Gayas, the storehouse of all energy. The Lord's Gayas are whitish blue, like the luster of the linseed flower, and appear most graceful when the Lord is carried on the shoulders of Garuda. Also, the yogi should contemplate his rounded hips, which are encircled by a girdle that rests on the exquisite yellow silk cloth that extends down to his ankles. Are there any words that you don't understand? You understand girdle? No. In Radhadesh, they didn't understand either. A couple of weeks ago, someone from Croatia said, "What is girdle?" Girdle means a belt. Like on the deity, we see there's a beaded belt or some kind of belt. So his hips are encircled by a girdle, and it rests on the exquisite yellow silk cloth that extends down to his ankles. Any other words? The Lord's thighs are whitish blue, like the luster of the linseed flower. I don't know what a linseed flower looks like, but it's white and blue. So the Lord's thighs resemble that. The Lord's thighs are the storehouse of all energy. And when the yogi should fix his mind in meditation on the Lord's thighs, which appear most graceful when the Lord is carried on the shoulders of Garuda. So that's the image. The personality of Godhead is the reservoir of all strength, and his strength rests on the thighs of his transcendental body. His whole body is full of opulences, all riches, all strength, all fame, all beauty, all knowledge, and all renunciation. The yogi is advised to meditate upon the transcendental form of the Lord, beginning from the soles of the feet, and then gradually rising to the knees, the thighs, and finally arriving at the face. The system of meditating on the Supreme Personality of Godhead begins from his feet. The description of the transcendental form of the Lord is exactly represented in the Archa Vigraha, the statue in the temples. Generally, the lower part of the body of the statue of the Lord is covered with yellow silk. And that is the Vaikuntha dress, or the dress the Lord wears in the spiritual sky. This cloth extends down to the Lord's ankles. Thus, since the yogi has so many transcendental objectives on which to meditate, there is no reason for his meditating on something imaginary, as is the practice of so-called yogis whose objective is impersonal. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Smate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasati Devam Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunvari Pastire Starine. So we say Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. The Srila Prabhupada is situated at the lotus feet of Lord Vishnu. So in the Vaishnava tradition, this idea of being a Vaishnava, devotee of Vishnu, is strong. Even the Krishna bhaktas identify themselves as devotees of Vishnu. But the instructions here are by Kapila Dev, and there are four yogis, but they're called devotional service. Lord Kapila's instructions on devotional service is the name of the chapter. And the two traditions, yoga and Krishna bhakti, are brought together in the purport in various ways. Srila Prabhupada compared the Archa Vigraha to the form that the yogi meditates on. The yogi is doing this just in his purified mind after he's completed his practice of asanas and pranayama and so on. He develops power of concentration, power to control the mind, and withdraw from sense objects. And of course he's alone in the forest. So his mind becomes a place where he can meditate on the transcendental objectives. Transcendental objectives, that's mentioned here. The yogi has so many transcendental objectives on which to meditate. So those objectives are the bodily parts of the Lord and the dress of the Lord, the ornaments of the Lord. None of these are considered material. When we speak about the opulences of the Lord, as this purport in verse 2, he's the reservoir of all strength and so on. It's not a material strength that we're talking about, but something transcendental. His energy is the internal energy that he lives within, the internal energy, and Satchidananda. And the material energy contains just a reflection of that. So we find these things reflected in the material world. Even we possess these opulences in a minute degree, but in a material way, we're connected with the material energy. So we've experienced these opulences as they're connected to the material energy, but not the Supreme Lord. When he exhibits his opulences, they're transcendental. They're part of the spiritual world. Therefore, meditating on a yellow silk cloth, Lord Vishnu. And if it's worn by the deity, it also becomes transcendental, used in the Lord's service. It becomes spiritualized. Matter used in the energy of spirit is also spiritual, Brahman. So the Bhagavatam is bringing together various strands of the Vedic tradition: yoga, Sankhya. Earlier the chapters were on Sankhya Yoga. We were also studying this section of the Bhagavatam, chapters 26, 27, recently in Radhadesh. And it's interesting to read about the Sankhya of the Bhagavat. It's theistic, it's not atheistic. There's also an atheistic Sankhya. There was someone in India, Ishvara Krishna, who propounded this atheistic Sankhya, which is now considered one of the six schools of Indian philosophy. And that discusses the Prakriti and the Purusha, like we were discussing last night, Krishna mentions that in the 13th chapter of the Gita. It discusses the gunas. But the beyond just the prakriti and the purusha, the souls and matter, there's the Ishvara, Krishna, that's left out of the atheistic Sankhya system. And the Bhagavad school brings this idea of a supreme controller directly to Krishna and links it directly to Krishna, identifies this Ishvara as Krishna. Whereas in Sankhya, Ishvara is just all that's said about the supreme controller, it's used in the Vedas and so on. But in the Bhagavad school, it's Ishvara is Krishna. He's the one who propels the Purushas into contact with the Prakriti. And he gets the gunas working. He gets time working. So he controls everything. Krishna is all of this. He's all the causes. The cause of all causes. And so because of this, because he's the single cause of everything, there's a monistic element in the Bhagavatam also, the idea that absolute truth is one, or Brahman is one, that everything is identical with Brahman. And the Acharyas later distinguish into different degrees between monism and dualism. So this Ishvara, Brahman, and Krishna, it's all connected. And this goes back to the Upanishads and the Vedanta. The Upanishads and Vedanta talk about Brahman as the highest aspect, or as the highest truth. But that's also identified with Krishna in the Bhagavad school. So as far as our being yogis goes, we're quite active for yogis. We don't sit down for a long time. We get up and do things. We're bhakti yogis. The actual yogis would sit in meditation for a long time, and that means many thousands of years in some cases. They had a method of living in which practically they had to do nothing except meditate. How they took care of their bodily necessities of sleeping and eating, it's not described too much, but maybe sometimes they didn't eat for a long time. Maybe they just meditated for days and nights. I'm not sure exactly how it went, but the idea I'm trying to get at is that their meditation was undisturbed. It could continue for a long time. And they had, this gives us an idea how much power of mind they had. Their mental powers were so well developed that they could envision the object of meditation and make their mind absorb their mind in the transcendental objectives of Lord Vishnu's form and so on, starting with the lotus feet. Sometimes in our temples we get visitors from other groups who meditate. And when they hear about how systematic this meditation is, how the devotees are advised to meditate on the feet and the thighs and go up gradually to the face, they find it uh, maybe more painstaking or detailed than the kind of meditation they do. Many people meditate, that's because many people meditate on something imaginary, that's mentioned in the purport. But there's no reason, Prabhupada says, for meditating on something imaginary as far as the yogi is concerned, because he doesn't have an objective that's impersonal. Many people meditate on something impersonal. They put up a mandala on the wall. Or, for example, the Shivananda Ashram. One devotee was telling us in Radhadesh that he used to go to the Shivananda Ashram in Geneva, Switzerland. And there, they had to sit for half an hour and just meditate on the flame of a candle. And to just keep the mind quiet by looking at the candle flame. No cell phone. Not supposed to be interrupted. You know, you. The mind is such that Prabhupada says, if you hear a sound, then immediately your mind goes there, just like that ringing of the cell phone. So the devotee was telling us it was hard for him. It was the hardest part of the meditation in the Shivananda Ashram to sit quietly and meditate on the flame of the candle. So imagine doing that continuously and trying to bring in the whole picture of the form of the Lord and meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord and so on and derive the benefit. It's not just a matter of mechanically, you know, making a picture in your mind, but you're meant to derive the transcendental benefits of contacting the Lord in this way. Just like we chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare. And we're trying to get the benefit. We've read about the benefits. We hear the descriptions all the time about the benefits of chanting, how potent it is, how it's none different than the Lord. And we're trying to get the benefit from that. We're trying to realize that. So similarly, the yogis were trying to realize the Lord by meditating on His form. And there's all kinds of benefits to derive. You come into contact with the internal energy of the Lord. This morning I was looking up a few things in the database in connection with this verse so I could explain it better. One of the first things that struck me was this description of Garuda. He's the carrier of the Lord, and you know that. The Lord rides on his shoulders. We see some beautiful BBT paintings of that, how graceful the Lord looks sitting on Garuda's shoulder. So we're familiar with that image, but this word used, Suparna, for Garuda, I didn't know what that was, so I looked it up. That's actually a name that he got from his mother. His mother's name was Suparna. The accent on the last syllable, long A on the Suparna. Ladies' names in India have accent on the last syllable, long vowel, held twice as long. So her name was Suparna, and she gave birth to Garuda. So he became known as Suparna. His mother was married to Kashyapa Muni. So here you have an instance of a human progenitor who gives rise to other species of life. This is how the Bhagavatam describes the origin of various species of life. They come from progenitors who are in human form. This is just how the creation got started. This was the Lord's arrangement. Other wives, he had four wives. Kashyapa had four wives. One wife gave birth to many kinds of birds. Another gave birth to insects. One wife gave birth to serpents. And one wife gave birth to the chariot driver of the sun god, So imagine belonging to a family like that and having a family reunion. Imagine having a family like that and having a family reunion. It's amazing. The other account, of course, of the origin of species is Darwin's account. We were discussing Charles Darwin in Ljubljana also. He was not that good of a student, and know what he wanted to do, and didn't like school that much. But at one point, you know, he went to South America, and he was impressed by the species of life there. He began to make many up, and then he came up with this idea that there's this natural selection, that the fittest living entities in a given population, they're the ones that survive, they're the ones who pass on their traits to the next generation. But he realized that this would be a controversial theory, and so he didn't publish it at once. He waited 20 years to publish it because he was afraid of creating a scandal. People at that time were God-fearing, and they believed in the Bible, and he knew this would challenge the order in society. Of course, now the theory has come to the point, microbiology. The scientists who believe in evolution say now it's a matter actually of understanding that it's the genes that control and drive evolution. The genes, the DNA and all of that, they've mapped the DNA, and they say this is what gives rise to, you know, whether you're left-handed or right-handed or have four legs or six legs or a big smile and blue eyes. These things are all in the genes. So they're beginning to get a sense of what it's like to manipulate the genes. They say that for the benefit of humanity, they will get rid of disease. If a baby has disease in the womb, they'll manipulate the genes in such a way that the gene that produces the disease is turned off. And then they can turn on other genes. They can make the baby maybe more with other qualities, good qualities, so they can manipulate like this. And this genetic engineering is going to be very profitable to the scientists. You can be sure that that's why they're pursuing this. They're going to sell it as beneficial to human society, but one of their interests is, of course, making profit, huge profits. And they have the sense of playing God. They're thinking, we're as good as God. We can do whatever, you know, God is said to be able to do. We've learned how to do it too. So they're really messing around with the material energy. And the desire to control the material energy is so strong. They're meditating. Krishna's giving them intelligence, you could say, to meditate on the material energy. But it's different than the yogi's meditation. He's fixed on the personality. He's considering the source of all energy. He's not trying to control or manipulate the energy. Here the verse says that the thighs of the Lord are the storehouse of energy. This is a little bit of a contrast with Bhagavatam gives us of the universal form. The other descriptions say that from the arms of the Lord you have the kshatriyas produced. Kshatriyas are produced. They're strong. So their strength and bodily strength comes from the arms of the universal form. That's described. And from the thighs or the stomach of the Lord, of the Lord's universal form, it says that the vaishyas come. And they're expert in productivity and wealth. So it's a little bit of a contrast. Here the thighs of the Lord are described as the storehouse of all energy. Another way to see that the thighs are close to the reproductive organs, and of course the reproductive organs are a source of all energy of life, so maybe that's part of the meaning given here. Or another way to understand it is that the thighs of the body hold up the rest of the body, and in that sense they're the storehouse of energy, they're supporting the whole body. Earlier I was telling you about the opulences of the Lord, how they're transcendental. This is also discussed in Bhagavad Gita in certain ways. In the 11th chapter, when Arjuna sees the universal form, he sees that there's no limit to the Lord's limbs. His limbs are hundreds and thousands of limbs, heads. There's no limit to the ability of the Lord to extend his form. Arjuna says, "You have numberless arms." And the purport today says there's no limit to the extent of the six opulences of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We can just sense this by thinking of the sun and the moon we see every day. The sun and the moon. They're far away, and they're out there in space. They're floating. And how much heat and light the sun gives every day. We would be very unhappy if we didn't have the light of the sun every day. Lord Brahma praises the sun. You know that verse in the Brahma Samhita? Jachaksuresa sakala grahanam rajasamastasuramuttir ase sateja jasyagnaya brahmati samvritakala chakru govindamari purusham jamanyami. There he says that the sun and the moon are like, he says the sun is one of the eyes of the Lord. And none of us can create a sun or a moon. So we sense how limited we are in power and how unlimited are these things. The sun has been giving light and heat since the beginning of time, and still it's not diminished. Still it's producing the heat and light. Asesa teja means unlimited, endless energy, heat and light. You can't even look at the sun. There's so much light coming from it. And if a little too much light in your eyes, and it's too strong for you to look at. Yesterday when we were walking in the park downtown, you know, the sun is low now because it's winter, and it's coming almost into our eyes very strongly. And after a few days of not seeing the sun, we were happy to see it, but in one sense it was too strong. So it's very strong, the sun. Now as far as the opulences go, the opulences of the Lord are enjoyed by the devotees also, with all entities. They have a little portion of the Lord's opulences. But the devotees in particular, they're like the servants of the king. And servants enjoy almost on an equal level. So we get, as a result of our service, we get eternal happiness and something imperishable. We enjoy eternal life. This accompanies devotional service. And in the spiritual world, we'll see how the Lord's opulences are exhibited, really, in the spiritual world. Although here too, we get a reflection of that. This is how Krishna maintains people. He maintains people by giving them a certain allotment of opulences, so that they can accomplish what they want in this world. They have some power, they have some intelligence, wealth, some beauty. They want these things also. That's why they're in the material world. They want to enjoy, like Krishna. Last night one girl was asking, why does a living entity come to the material world if he's happy in the spiritual world. Srila Prabhupada said that if you associate with some really big person, you know, for example, one devotee in Slovenia, once he was working for the new president, current president of Slovenia, he had some opportunity once to do some service. So he was lugging him tea and stuff like that. And when you associate with a big person, sometimes you get the desire to be that person. I want to enjoy like him. Once I was at the London Temple, and the very famous, wealthy, so he goes to the London Temple in the morning for darshan at 7 o'clock, 7:15. He lives near the temple, and he and his brothers live in this nice mansion, and this in London early in the morning, get some exercise, and they stop at the temple for darshan. Or sometimes they take their car. So one morning, I was downstairs on the street, just after Sri Chand Hinduja's car pulled up, and I was admiring his car, Rolls Royce, you know. And I thought, oh, look, you know, Rolls Royce, very nice. And then later that afternoon, I was thinking, you know, it would be nice if I had a car like that. So that tendency is so strong. If you associate with someone who has lots of opulence, then you think, well, I should enjoy like that too. So like that, we get this idea, let's imitate Krishna. But the Bhagavatam makes the point that when Krishna exhibits his opulences in the material world, he's not exhibiting material powers, he's exhibiting spiritual powers. His powers don't have to do with the modes of nature, but our opulences are like that. They're in connection with the modes. So in the verses that are coming up, there's lots of further descriptions of various parts of the Lord's body, and there's more to learn about. The Lord's body is the source of so many things, and we'll see, just like we discussed yesterday, how Brahma is an extension of the Lord. Each part of the Lord has something that the devotees or the yogis draw from. The yogis, it'll be described how they get their mystic powers from the bosom of the Lord, the bosom or chest of the Lord, neck area. That's another area where the powers of the Lord are stored. And you who get in their meditation up to the point of the bosom of the Lord, then they start to get mystic powers at that point by meditating on the Lord's chest and neck. It's very interesting how all these things are coming about. The origin of all these things are explained. I can stop there. I'll take some questions. There's time. Marcy? Well, the six schools of philosophy are Sankhya, Naya, logic, Vedanta, Kama Mamamsa. Krishna articulated Karma Mamamsa philosophy when he wanted to initiate the Govardhan Puja. That's four. Then there's two more. There's Nishesh Vaisheshika and one more. You can look it up. At Bhaktivedanta College, we had a course on these. One graduate student, a devotee who's in graduate school, he came and taught a course on the six philosophies of India. So the students and they had to look at some of the ideas. A lot of these they tend to be a bit godless, more materialistic, just talking about the material energies and the breakdown of the material energies into different categories. A lot of them leave out the Supreme Controller. They just say that time is the controller or karma is the controller. Yoga is one. Patanjali Yoga, that's it. There was a scholar named Karl Potter. He wrote a book called The Six Systems of Indian Philosophy. Around the 1960s, he wrote this book. And it was a textbook in college when I was at the University of Minnesota. And he was there. He was teaching at the University of Minnesota at that time. And I was thinking of taking his course because I was interested in, a little bit in Buddhism and Indian philosophy. But I didn't take his course. And then later, after I became a devotee, he was one of the persons who endorsed Srila Prabhupada's books. He wrote a favorable review of Prabhupada's books. And I got to meet him later in Seattle. He ended up at the University of Seattle. And once I was in Seattle for a few months, so I went over there and I looked him up and had a talk with him. And of course, you know, we could immediately talk because I told him I was at the University of Minnesota and he was too. So, you know, friendly, on a friendly basis then for talking. We talked about ISKCON and Krishna consciousness. Another question? Again? Yes, I mentioned another one last night. Prabhupada gave the analogy of a rich man who can enjoy. That's like us in the spiritual world. If we have all opulences, you know, that we can have in the spiritual world, what makes us want to go to the material energy, which is a source of suffering? So the analogy Prabhupada gave was a rich man can enjoy any kind of food. He enjoys basmati rice, nice savories, fried in ghee, any opulent food he can have. But sometimes he sees that the servants are enjoying food that's not as expensive. They have their own preparations, you know, that they like, that they don't have a budget like the rich man. So they have to cook things that are less expensive, less high quality food. But they manage to enjoy that. They develop a taste for that, and they like that. Prabhupada said once he tried to give his servants basmati rice. He thought, they're such nice servants. They're eating this short, cheap rice. Maybe I should, you know, be generous and arrange for them also to get basmati rice. So he did that, and after a couple of days, the servants came to him and said, you're really, you know, a good master. We like you. We like the way you engage us in service. But please let us eat our rice. We don't like the basmati rice. So yeah, they have their own taste. And the rich man, he might then become curious. What is that taste like that they like? You know, they're conditioned by the modes in a certain way, subtle conditions, so they like their own kinds of food. So different people have different tastes. And someone who is enjoying a higher taste, he might at some point want to know, what is that lower taste like? So it could be some curiosity also. What is the material world like? We're to touch the Shakti, we're on the borderline, and we're described the soul can serve either energy, the immaterial energy or the spiritual energy. We have that potency. So sometimes we're going one way into the material world. But some souls don't ever make that choice. They stay in the spiritual energy. Nitya siddhas. But rebellion is there too, the idea of rebelling against God. Why should Krishna be God? Why shouldn't I enjoy like Krishna? That's mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. Icha dveshas. Icha means the desire, and dvesha means the resentment or the enviousness of God. Conditioned souls have those. Yeah, but Yogamaya doesn't mean that your independence is removed. If everybody's just a robot in the spiritual world, then there's no real love or individuality. The fact is we have individuality and independence. And if we want to choose Mahamaya, we can. Yogamaya doesn't prevent us from choosing Mahamaya. We have that choice. So we learned something. We have to learn something about Krishna's energies. It's you know, for Krishna, from the point of view of Krishna, it's just like we're in a dream, you know, we're in the dream of Mahavishnu. And when we wake up, then we wake up and resume our activities in the spiritual world. It's not a big thing. In terms of eternal time, our stay in the material world is not very long, although it seems eternal when you're here. I'm sorry, I missed what you said. I can't get it. From a certain perspective. Well, I heard that Krishna tries to talk us out of it. Krishna says, no, don't do it. You won't be happy there. But we persist. Prabhupada said, we persist. We ask God, I want this, I want it. And we're like kids. And then what is the Father going to do? Okay, take it. But a fan, Prabhupada said the fan was spinning, you know. And the kid wanted to touch it. And the father said, no, don't touch it. It was his own experience. And then so his father said, okay, just a minute. He turned off the fan. He waited till it slowed down, pretty much. Then he said to Abai, okay, now touch it. And Abai touched it. Ah! You know, he hurt his finger. So he learned that way. But Yogamaya, that doesn't act like, you know, a prison guard and not let us out. It's not like she's, like Durga said to hold us, you know, Durga can keep us in this material prison until we surrender to Krishna. But Yogamaya doesn't act like that. If we want to go out of the spiritual world, we can. But once we learn our lesson, then we go back to the spiritual world, and we never return to the material energy. Sir? Very good question. Good question. Why? There's been some explanations offered by senior devotees in ISKCON. A few years ago, when this topic was being discussed throughout ISKCON, some devotees wrote papers on this, and Ridananda Maharaj and Ravindra Sarup wrote philosophical explanations of why there's this apparently irreconcilable difference in the statements of Prabhupada's purports. So, in brief, the explanation is that it is permissible, possible to say the soul never falls from Vaikuntha, because when the soul comes to this world, its nature doesn't change, although it becomes covered by material elements. The essential nature of the soul never changes. In that sense, the soul isn't fallen. It's just in contact with the material energy of the Lord for some time. But the material energy of the Lord is also a spiritual energy. Everything from Krishna is connected to Him. So even the material energy is a manifestation of Krishna. And we can see, Prabhupada says, we can see Krishna in the material energy. He sometimes describes like that. And as far as there being a contradiction, an apparent contradiction, what about a philosophical system that has an apparent contradiction in it? Is that a lower grade philosophical system? Not necessarily, because Rita Nandamaraj was making the point that in order to get the mind of a conditioned soul who thinks just in terms of logic and rational thinking, to try to see something beyond his limited ability to think, a contradiction may help get him out of, you know, the box in which he's usually thinking. Just like in Zen, they have these koans. What is the sound of one hand clapping? You're supposed to meditate on that. Why? Because you're supposed to move your mind beyond the usual pattern in which it thinks. So to point to something that's transcendental to the material laws, to point to something transcendental beyond material laws, a contradiction can help a thinker. Now, if you want to read these papers, you can read them. They're on the Veda base. You can. Ravinder Shrup goes into it a lot. He discusses how difficult it is, really, when you come close to the border of the material world, where the eternal spiritual world and the material world are very close. There's a border. And that's like where the demigods, like Brahma, are situated. They're on top of the material world, and therefore time for them. Time moves very, very slow. They have very long lives. Time is relative in the material world. For us, in the middle planetary systems, time works another way. For the ants and insects, time works another way. Their lifetime is very short. And these are very difficult things to think about. Eternal. How does the eternal, how does time, you know, read some article on time. Read what philosophers say about time. They really struggle trying to understand it. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about conditioned soul, how it becomes influenced by time. And Ravinder discusses some of the points. And he says this is one thing that makes it very difficult to understand this issue. Have you read Ravinder's papers? Would you like to? They're good. A couple of years ago, I think it was 96, these things were a big controversy in ISKCON, and Ravinder produced a couple of papers. And I remember reading them. Sometimes I would sit with the devotees and just we'd read the paper together and discuss it. It's in the ISKCON archives now, ISKCON, Bhaktivedanta Vedabase. You can look these things up. Again? Maybe just the latest ones? It's possible. Yeah, because the Back to Godhead articles, it was originally Back to Godhead article. And that was, I think in 2003, the database began including the Back to Godhead articles. Previously they didn't. Yeah, now everything that was published in Back to Godhead is on the database. I can give them to you. If you have a memory stick, I'll put them on your memory stick. Are you in school studying university philosophy? Very good. What's your name? Pavle. Where do you study in Zagreb? Religion and science. Religious science. At Bhaktivedanta College, we just had a course on religion and science for the first time. We spent 10 days looking at some of the issues. Okay. Is there any other place? Brahmajyoti? Not forever. You can annihilate your personality like the Buddhists, and you can stay as a place for the Buddhists, a kind of void. Not really a void, but a kind of... Prabhupada said there's no void in Krishna's creation, but the Buddhists have some place where, you know, after dismantling their ego, it seems like, you know, they've reached nirvana. There's some place like that for them. In a sense, we are having it in the spiritual world. Because we're part of the spiritual world, the spirit soul. We have all the qualities that we have in the spiritual world. They're just before. Well, we're having it now. Why have it there? You can't have it there because that's a place where rebellious souls cannot stay. If you stay in the spiritual world, you have to serve Krishna. We're the cheaters, not Krishna. We're big cheaters. We're cheaters. Just, well, Prabhupada says that we shouldn't pursue this subject too much. He says how and when we came to this material world, we can't trace it out. He says this in the Bhagavad Gita purport that we read last night. But he said Krishna knows. Krishna knows all these things. Can you keep track of every living entity in this creation? No, but Krishna can. We don't have that power, but Krishna knows how and when we came. We don't have the ability to figure it out. So therefore, don't spend a lot of time on it. It's another way to waste time in the material world. Yeah. Now I think we should chant Hare Krishna. There's one computer upstairs. If you hit a button and it says recording of Prabhupada, now I think we should chant Hare Krishna. Okay, let's stop, huh? And take some prasadam. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much, all glories to Prabhupada.